tassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami Tonight I'd like to elaborate on a talk that I've given recently at the Nuns Monastery to those people who've brought dana. So some of you will have heard parts of this talk before, but I'm sure it will be of use because it is on one of the very fundamental aspects of the Buddha's teaching, and that is the nature of suffering, of dukkha. The Buddha's first noble truth, that life is inherently unsatisfactory. And very often when people know that the talk is about dukkha, suffering, again, they think, oh, why don't they talk about something pleasant once in a while? Especially this is the festive season. Can't they talk about something that's joyful? And so that's an interesting thing to observe in your mind if that is your reaction to hearing again about dukkha. Because one of the important things to remember when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths is that he not only pointed out suffering, but he also pointed out the cause of suffering and the way out of suffering. And so when we are listening to a teaching about dukkha, then we're also listening to a teaching about the way out of suffering. And so it is actually a very good, appropriate talk for this festive season, because that's the wonderful thing about the Buddha, that he has given us tools to work with to come out of our suffering. And dukkha means that which is difficult to bear. And it's important for us to understand dukkha in its different aspects as explained by the Buddha, so that we really know what it is we're dealing with. If we don't have an understanding of dukkha in its various aspects, then it's very easy to keep it at arm's length while ever life is going along quite smoothly, and then to be overwhelmed when something happens that we don't like. So if we become more familiar with dukkha, then we are in effect preparing ourselves for the ups and downs of life. And when I first came in contact with the Buddha's teaching, for me it was a great relief to encounter this teaching on the fact that life is inherently unsatisfactory. Because up until that point, like everyone else, I was under the delusion that somehow, if you only knew the right things to do, that you could make life perfect. If you had the right job, passed the right tests, had whiter teeth, had the right partner, if you moved to the right place and took the right holidays, eventually you would get to the stage where you could live happily ever after. And after trying and trying and trying to get the ingredients right, I kept coming up with the experience that that's not how things are in life. But it wasn't what society was telling me. Society was telling me that I just didn't have the right partner, or the right, live in the right place, or have the right job yet. Once I did all those things, then I would eventually get to a place where things were fine. So the teaching of the Buddha, which was pointing out that even if you get all of those things and life is fine or perfect for a while, that it's not going to stay that way for long, because it's just the nature of life that things will change. And so even if you have all of the right ingredients the end result is going to be eventually what you don't want it to be. And this was another interesting thing for me to experience, because I knew that it is possible to have good times. It is possible to enjoy myself and have happiness and pleasure, as each one of you will have discovered in your life. There are plenty of things which are enjoyable. And if there weren't so many things that are enjoyable in life, we wouldn't be so hooked on it. We wouldn't be still trying to find that place where things don't change or only change in the ways that we like them to. So the Buddha's teaching isn't saying that it's not possible to have any sort of happiness or pleasure in life, but what he's also pointing out to us that no matter how good it gets, that it won't stay like that for long. And so when I examined my experience, I could see that there were ups and downs in life, and the up times were good, but certainly there was always this anticipation after enough experience that they weren't going to last. And so when I discovered the Buddha's teaching that was pointing out that life is inherently unsatisfactory because of this part of reality, this constant change, it was a great relief to me. And it helped me to be more realistic about life and not to expect more from life than it could offer. And that's why I think this particular teaching is very important for all of us to come to know, not at arm's length, but very close to home in our personal experience of daily life. And especially at this time of the year, when the consumer society is at its height and we're encouraged to indulge in mad spending in order to have a spiritual experience of some kind, because it is Christmas, we can observe for ourselves how off target society can be. And so it's important for us to be able to reflect in terms of our own experience. So I'm going to outline the three aspects of dukkha which the Buddha said that we should be familiar with. The first of these aspects is called dukkha dukkata, and that is the ordinary aches and pains, ups and downs, physical and mental suffering that we experience because we've been born as human beings. We have this human body, and we're born through in the pain of our mother, and we come into this world and we're completely dependent on other people to look after us. And this is suffering, because if they don't look after us well, then we're going to feel the effects of that. So birth is suffering. And then as we go through life, we're likely to encounter just physical discomfort, the physical realities of looking after this body day after day. How many times do we have to brush our teeth? How many times do we have to wash ourselves? How many times do we have to feed ourselves? And how many times do we have to go to the toilet so we can start all over again? Just to have this human body is full of discomfort. And no matter how well we look after it, we're likely to get sick sometime. And so we're likely to experience the suffering of sickness. And even if we don't suffer any sickness during our life, we're all eventually going to die. So birth, sickness, old age and death. And these are realities for everyone. And yet each one of us has this little hope in the back of our mind that it's really not ever going to happen to me, that big D, death. So far it's always happened to someone else. I've always been around to watch it. And because we haven't experienced it, or we don't have conscious memory of it, there's this niggling hope that somehow we're going to be the one person in history who's never died. And this is laughable, but it's a reality for many people. They keep the idea of their own death at arm's length. And so the Buddha said, that's not good enough. You have to bring it much closer to home. And we'll talk about that when we look at the other aspects of suffering. But the Buddha said there are, as well as the realities of this human body and how much effort we have to put into maintaining it and looking after it, and for all our efforts, in the end, it's going to give up. It's no longer going to be able to be put back together again. It's going to die. There are also other aspects of the unsatisfactoriness of life that we come in contact with. Not getting what we want, losing what we want to keep, and coming in contact with those things which we'd rather avoid. From the smallest kind of dissatisfaction, the sort of dissatisfaction we feel when we go to butter our toast in the morning and we discover that the butter dish is empty, and by the time we get the new butter out of the fridge, the toast will be cold. It won't be nearly as tasty anymore. Or the dissatisfaction of having to work in an environment that we don't like, working with people that we don't like. And it just sort of niggles away at us day after day. To the very strong unhappiness that comes when someone whom we love doesn't return that love. They love someone else. Or they love us for a while and then they love someone else. Or maybe we love them for a while, but then we no longer love them, we can't stand them. How do we get out of this? That sort of dissatisfaction which we all experience in various degrees in our life. This is the ordinary dukkha, dukkata. And we all have ways of coping with these things in our experience. And one teacher has very nicely described our ways of dealing with these difficulties as we all have our babysitters. The babysitters are the things that we reach for to make it a little more bearable. So we dye our hair when we start to see that age is catching up with us. Or we change our partner because I no longer like the way you look. You remind me that I'm getting old too. We move away from the situations or the places that we don't like. It's their fault. If I was living somewhere else where it was cooler, I'd be happier. Or if I was living somewhere where it's hotter, I'd be happier. We take all kinds of care with our diet. We take all the kind of supplements that we've read are going to make us have that zing again. And of course, you can see I'm speaking from the perspective of middle age. If I was young, I'd probably be talking in a different way, but I'm sort of looking at it from over the hill and seeing the effects now. And so this is what I experience in my own life. This is how I can see my babysitters coming in. How am I going to deal with this thing and make it as comfortable, as bearable as possible? How can I have something in my life which will help me to close my eyes on the reality of what's happening, that this body is ageing, is getting less energetic, is affected by having to do physical work in a way that it wasn't affected a few years ago? All of these changes. If I can just have ginseng tea, that's the latest thing for me. Ginseng's where endurance lies. So all of us have our babysitters. But unless we understand what we're doing, that we're trying to cope with the realities of life, then very often we can look outside ourselves for an answer to our difficulty, or we can blame ourselves, or we can blame someone else for our predicament. So the fact that our body is ageing, that's the way it is. But some people can't accept that. And so they go and have a bit taken off there and a bit added here to try to get over the feeling that what's happening to their body is not a natural process. And as ridiculous as it may seem, some people even want to blame their deterioration on another person. That if I'm miserable, then you've got to be miserable along with me. Someone was telling me a very poignant story recently about a husband and wife, where the husband in his 70s had had a stroke. And being a very independent person, he refused to follow the physiotherapy instructions that he was given. He wouldn't cooperate with the treatments because it was his body, he knew better, and he didn't want to acknowledge that something was happening out of his control. And so he wasn't able to recover very well from the debilitating stroke that he had. And so it was impossible for his wife to look after him at home. And so eventually they decided to sell their family home, and he would go into a nursing home, and the wife would live in a smaller unit where she could look after herself and still come and visit him and see to his needs in the nursing home. But eventually, within a very short time, he wasn't satisfied with that because he was stuck in the nursing home. Why should his wife be out there in her little flat doing what she could do with her life? And so after a period of time, only a fairly short period of time, his wife ended up selling the little unit that she was in and coming to live with him in the nursing home. And they live in one room in the nursing home, and they have two single beds, one along one wall, one along the other, and they have a television set, and that's all they can fit into that room in the nursing home. Now, this is a true story. This is how someone has lived their life. This is how someone has faced up to the reality of old age, sickness, and death. And it's very sad to think that someone has lived in this way and is then able to have such a traumatizing effect on the people around, demanding that his wife should come and live with him and be with him in the nursing home. If I've got to be here, then so should you. Now, another person was telling me quite a different story recently. She was telling me how she and her husband had discussed how they were going to deal with the fact that one of them might have a debilitating illness and not be able to live at home any longer. And she said that they'd already decided that if one of them needed full-time care, that they would organise it so that person went into a nursing home and where they could get the care, and the person who was still able would continue to live either in the family home or in smaller premises, so that they could still enjoy the life that they were able to lead. And in this situation, the fact that they have considered that this is a possibility for them and that they've talked about it and also given consideration to what would be best for the person that I've lived my life with. These people have been married for 40 years or something, so they want the best for their partner, and in considering this as a possibility, they're being realistic about what may happen in their life. So when we come in contact with dukkha, when we come in contact with the reality of life, it's not a cause to be miserable necessarily. It makes us more realistic, and if we're more realistic, then we plan for things so that we don't just get bowled over when they happen to us in maybe a time that we weren't expecting them to. If you ask anyone if they're ready for death, they'll always say, well, not quite, a little bit later. If it could come next year, or after I've had a bit more time, or if I could just get my affairs in order. No one, very, very rarely, is anyone prepared for their death right now. And so I encourage you to reflect on the fact that with Christmas and New Year around the corner, if you were relating to your death as being as much of a fact of your life as your expectation that Christmas is going to happen in a couple of weeks' time and New Year is going to happen in a couple of weeks' time, if your death was as real to you as the fact that Christmas and New Year are coming, how would you be spending your time? Because we don't know whether Christmas and New Year will come for us. The people who were in Darwin in 1975 or whatever it was were expecting Christmas, and the day before Christmas, Cyclone Tracy came. We don't know whether we've got a Cyclone Tracy about to hit us in our life, and we may not see Christmas or New Year. And so this is something for us to reflect on. How real is it? Certainty that sometime I'm going to die, and then how will I live my life until I die? So this is only the first aspect of suffering. That's bad enough, isn't it? The second aspect of suffering, which helps it to come closer to our own experience, to our daily experience, is called sankhara dukkata. And that's the unsatisfactoriness that arises because nothing in this world exists independently of causes and conditions. Nothing exists which is not subject to influence or change because of other factors outside itself. And this applies to everything we see in the material world. It applies to our mind and it applies to our body. So everything is made up of component parts which work together and have to be supported by other causes and conditions. So to give an example, the example that many people can relate to is the example of a house. And the Buddha said, in actual fact, in absolute reality, there's no such thing in existence as a house. A house is just relative reality. It's a conventional term. What we call a house is actually space surrounded by walls and a roof. And if you take away the walls and the roof, you've got space again. Now, if we think in terms of something more elaborate than just four walls and a roof, we think about a house that has all the things in it completed, so that we say, this house is now finished. I've built my house, it's complete. So what does it mean to have a complete house? It means not only four walls and a roof, it means that you've got the sink and you've got the toilet and the bath and all of those things, the stove, all the fittings are in there. And not only the fittings, you've got the furnishings, the curtains and the lounge suite. And not only the furnishings, you've got the things that go in the drawers that make the kitchen workable, the spoons and the knives and the towels in the bathroom and the sheets in the bedroom. You have to have all of those things in there, all of those bits and pieces, all of those components before you can say that the house is complete. And if any of you have had the experience of having building a house or moving into a house and thinking, ah, now I've made it, now I've got my dream home, you'll know that it doesn't stay finished for long. Pretty soon after you've got everything there together, something breaks down, something doesn't work, or it's worn out. Or, for example, you realise that the curtains that are on the window aren't sufficient because the sun's too bright and you need to do something else with the window to make it comfortable. And then you need to clear out the gutters because they're full and they're going to need repair if you don't look after them. And then you might have the experience of the toilet breaks down. The toilet's an essential part of the house, so we have to get it fixed. Now, how do we get it fixed? Well, we have a fiddle with it, but it doesn't work. So then we have to get in the plumber. So how do we get in the plumber? Well, we call him up, but the plumber doesn't come for free. We have to pay the plumber. So how do we pay the plumber? Well, then we have to have money. How do we get money? We have to go to work. Okay, so I'm going to work to get the money to pay the plumber to fix the toilet. But now the company that I work for in Perth, that's a subsidiary of a main company in Japan. And the company in Japan has just gone broke. So the company in Perth is also shutting down. I've lost my job. I haven't got any money. I can't pay the plumber. He won't come in and fix the toilet. The toilet doesn't work. My house is not finished. And so this is what it means by component parts. All these things have to work together in order for us to have a finished product. And not only the material world outside ourselves, this body is the same. This body which we think of as me and which we think of as mine, I'm in control of my body. My body is just like the house. The Buddha said this body is just a bag of bones surrounded by skin. And it's full of all sorts of things that none of us would like to have sitting outside this body, outside this bag of skin. If we had our kidney and our liver and our bowels sitting in front of us, none of us would like to own them as me. And yet we know that if any of those things don't work well with each other, that the whole thing, the body, is no longer going to function well. But we also know that we can't control the way our body's going to work with our willpower. We find out that our liver's a bit dicky, it's not working as well as it should. So we can't just say with our mind, okay, liver, I'm in charge here, get going. We know that the liver is out of our control from the sense of willpower, and it depends on all sorts of other things that are going to nourish it and repair it and help it to work better. And if the liver's not working well, then we know that the chemicals in the system won't be in the right proportion, and that will affect the quality of the blood. That will affect how well the heart works, that will affect how well the lungs work, that will affect how well we can take in oxygen, that will affect how well we can breathe out our waste products, and we're in a mess if that liver doesn't work well. And so the body is dependent on so much of component parts and things working together out of our control. So we might take a lot of effort to keep ourselves healthy, make sure that everything's in good working order, and then a little virus that we can't even see with the naked eye comes into this body and makes us so sick that we can't even get out of bed. So we're very vulnerable in this human form. And if we think, well, okay, I give up on the body, I can understand that that's not under my control, I'll stick with the mind. That's where I really am. That's what I've got control over. We can see the same laws working in the mind as well. We think of my mind and I'm in control. I can think what I like. From now on, I'm only ever going to think good thoughts and I'm only ever going to be happy because it's my mind. I'm in control. And so we make the determination early in the morning, I'm not going to be miserable for one moment today. Going to really keep an eye on this mind and really keep it just in a good state. And so we have the experience that someone who comes to offer dana had one day when she was very happily making the dana in the morning and looking forward to coming up to Gijiganup to offer it, and was really in control of her mind. Everything was fine. It's very happy. She's going to be happy all day because she's doing a good thing that she likes. And when she walked out to put the things in the car, she looked in her garden and she saw that something was different. And she looked again and she realised that her letterbox had been stolen. My letterbox has been stolen. Who could have stolen my letterbox? It's not even a new letterbox, it's an old letterbox. Who could have... And there, right away, that happy mind state, The idea that I'm going to be happy all day, no misery at all in this mind, suddenly went out the window. And this is how our mind operates. We are constantly affected by what we experience through contacting the world, through what we see, through what we hear, through what we taste, touch, think about, smell and feel. These things affect the mind that arises in the next moment. Our mind doesn't stay the same for one moment, and it doesn't exist independent of those other outer factors, or even the internal factor of I'm enjoying what I want to, what I'm about to do, but then I get a terrible headache. And because I get a terrible headache, an internal condition, the state of mind changes. I'm no longer interested. I'm no longer enjoying what I'm doing. And so you can see that this mind is just like the body. It's made up of component parts, one part which makes contact with the through the sense bases with objects, sounds, sights, one part of the mind which processes that and makes sense of it, and one part of the mind which reacts emotionally. And all of these aspects of the mind are affected by what we come in contact with. So the mind, just like the body, just like the house, is made up of component parts and affected by causes and conditions. And that's why there's suffering. It's suffering because it means that we can never get to happily ever after. We can never get to that state of perfection, because something is always about to change. Something is always about to change into something different, maybe something we like or maybe something we don't like. But we live in hope that we'll just, if I just have this, if I just do that, if I just go there, if I just make it through to the end of this year, everything will be fine. And it's a delusion. It's also, when we look at this truth, it also is something that we can work with. Because when we examine our experience and see how things are made up of components and also are affected by causes and conditions within ourselves and outside of ourselves, once we start to become familiar with that and don't resist it, we can start to identify which things work towards our happiness, which things promote our goodwill, our happiness, both physical and mental, and which things are not for our goodness, for our good, for our happiness. So instead of feeling that life is one big solid thing, we can see that it can be broken up into more manageable units. And this is very helpful, especially when we encounter problems. Especially in relationships, for example. Very often people will come and talk to me about the difficulties they're having in their relationships. And very often parents are having with their children, especially teenage children. And teaching is very useful to apply in this situation, because we see that our relationships, no matter how close they are constantly evolving. When we don't understand that, we have the attitude that they should be fixed throughout life, that our children, when they were 3 or 4, did what I told them to do, and they should follow that even when they're 19 or 20. But, of course, the child at 3 or 4 is completely dependent on you and hasn't got much choice. And so at that stage, it's quite a different situation to the 19-year-old. And if we look at the relationships as they evolve, we can identify the new factors that start to come into our relationships. So, for example, for teenagers, one of the new factors is very often, I've got my driver's license now, I can go where I like. That's a new factor. Or very close to parents for lots of the life and then suddenly fall in love. The boyfriend or the girlfriend is the new factor in the in the overall relationship. So if we start to identify these things as components of the relationship, we can start to look at our relationships in a more manageable way. So, for example, the teenager who now wants to spend all their time with their new girlfriend, we don't have to see them as terrible because they've turned their back on us, or terrible because they no longer obey when we say they should come home at a certain time, or that who gets into an argument because we say they can't have the car when they want it. This is just a new component in the overall relationship. And if we can see that there are many other components in the relationship, the positive things, the happy things, the good things, all of the other parts that contribute to that relationship, then this new factor doesn't become the bogeyman who takes over the whole of that relationship. And the other thing that this kind of understanding helps us to do throughout our life is not to take what we have for granted, not to take our relationships for granted, not to take the situation that we're in for granted, because we understand that all these things are subject to change, and that some change in one part is going to affect the other part. So we no longer are turning a blind eye to the things that we can do to improve our relationships. We're no longer expecting that things will stay always the way they've been, or necessarily that a change is a bad thing. It can be just an unfolding, can be just a maturing, it can be just a growing. But if we have an idea of things as being fixed and stable and static, then we're always going to be surprised when they do change. Of course, when they change in a way we like, we're going to enjoy that. But when they change in a way that we don't like, then we're going to be miserable. So understanding this teaching can help us again to be more realistic about life and to prepare ourselves to be more in touch with the truth of life. The last kind of dukkha is viparinama dukkata, and that is the suffering that arises again because of constant change. And we've already talked about change, the change that takes place when we die. But most of us are able to keep the reality of that change at arm's length. And the Buddha said that's not good enough, because if you do that, you won't be prepared for death when it comes. You can only really be prepared for a good death if you've lived life well, if you've lived life knowing that it is only temporary, but it's also very precious. And you learn to make best use of the time that we have, this human birth. But viparinama dukkata, as I said, is the suffering of change, but it's the suffering of change that takes place moment to moment in this mind and body. All of us know that when we were born, we weren't like we are now. We were born as a baby, quite helpless, and we didn't stay as a baby until we were, say, age 5, and then on the eve of our 5th birthday, we suddenly developed from a baby overnight until we were 5 and we could go to school the next day. And then we stayed as a 5-year-old for the next 5 years until on the eve of our 10th birthday, we suddenly changed into a 10-year-old and could do what 10-year-olds can do. All of us know that the change that's taken place to from the time of birth to as we are now has been a very gradual change, happening moment by moment. And if you look back on your life, you'll see that a lot of that change has been something that you've really enjoyed, that you've welcomed. As you were growing and able to be more competent, stronger, faster, able to do things that you weren't able to do previously, become more skillful, choose what you want to do rather than have someone else doing it for you. This kind of change, which has been happening moment to moment from the time of our birth, we've enjoyed, we've liked it. And then we get to a certain age, middle age maybe, or even late 20s and we start to see that the changes are happening in another direction. We can't see quite as well as we used to. We have to use glasses. We can't run quite as fast. In fact, we're not even interested in running anymore. These sorts of changes which take place little by little, moment by moment, now they start to be changes which we'd rather not have, and very often which we try to ignore. So it's important for us to understand that while these changes are happening beyond our control, and they're happening moment to moment, that it's not altogether something which is miserable for us. There are some aspects of change which we like. And this is also interesting, the way the mind works. If things don't change, we very soon get bored. And especially in today's society, with so much of strong visual impact and so many strong sensory stimulation available to us, boredom arises very quickly if there isn't something new, if there isn't a new flash in the pan happening. We get very bored very quickly. And so again, to see that change has its positive aspects as well as its negative aspects. But to really come very close to the change that's taking place in this body and mind, moment by moment, we need to develop the mind in meditation. Because it's only in meditation that we're able to really experience for ourselves that this change is happening, whether I like it or not, and largely out of my control. And so when we sit in meditation, we develop the clarity of mind, the calmness of mind, to be able to observe how much change is taking place moment by moment. So when we sit down to meditate and we make our posture as comfortable as possible, we notice that very soon after we've sat down, we start to feel some discomfort. Now, we may not even pay attention to that, but if we look closely, we'll see that that discomfort is happening because of physical change that has taken place in the body since we sat down. The fact that we're not moving is creating pressure on particular parts of the body. That pressure is making it difficult for the cells in that area of the body to work well, for the fluid to move, for the blood to move. So the muscles are being constricted, and the constricted muscles start to build up toxins, and then there's a feeling of strain in the muscle. And so if we observe, if we're prepared to look at this body in meditation without even analysing exactly what's happening, we can see how quickly this body becomes suffering. Body, we also can see how the mind is changing moment by moment. When we sit down to meditate, we don't have anything else to do but just pay attention to the breath. And we pay attention maybe to two breaths, and then the mind wanders away, and then we bring it back. And we watch one breath and the mind wanders away, and then we bring it back. And where does it wander to? Wanders to thinking. Wanders to thinking about the past or the future. Wanders to thinking about the body. But it wanders. It doesn't stay the same one moment, from one moment to the next. And this is what we can experience in the meditation itself, both the mind and the body, changing, 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 relentlessly. Not necessarily always for bad, but changing nonetheless. And it's only in meditation, when we are sufficiently calm and we have a mind that's strong enough, that we can stick with it and observe this change and start to become familiar with it, start to understand it, and start to see how the way that our mind and our body changes is affected by causes and conditions. And this is a very important lesson for us, because it helps us to train the mind to deal with the big change that we're all going to face, that is the change of from life to death. Because according to the Buddha's teachings, it's one mind moment of life and then one mind moment into the next birth. And we need to prepare our mind for the change that takes place at death by being able or being familiar with the fact that this is a natural process. It's been happening from the time I was born. It's been happening from the time I was conceived. Before I was conceived, I died somewhere to be born here. And so this is an ongoing process, not necessarily one that we have to fear, but one that we can become familiar with, and also familiar with how to make our mind change in a wholesome, skillful way, so that we develop those causes and conditions in our life which at the time of death help us to be peaceful, help us to be have some clarity, help us to be free of fear. So when we come very closely in contact with Viparinama Dukkata, although we understand that things are changing and very often changing out of our control, we see that we do have some potential to work at making changes happen in the way that we want them to. We can't stop the change, but we can give it direction. And this is the way that we work with this understanding of suffering. When we consider these three aspects of the inherent unsatisfactoriness of life, we can be very disappointed often because they don't fulfill our hunger for security, our hunger for certainty. And sometimes we can think that it's not fair. I deserve better than this. And we can resist the teaching because of this attitude of it's not fair. And sometimes we think it's a punishment. Why is it, does it have to be like this? And the Buddha's teaching isn't about trying to explain why it has to be like this. He's saying it is like this. And if you can accept that it's like this, then you can live your life more happily, making best use of it, not taking it for granted, and actively trying to cultivate those aspects of life which are going to bring peace and happiness for you. Sometimes when we see that things are out of our control, it can be a relief in another sense, because it points to the fact that there's nothing in our experience of life that is the ultimate experience that's going to give us happily ever after. Very often we are so disappointed or so anxious about the test that we have to do or the job that we have to get. We have to succeed in order for this thing to make my life happy. And we create so much suffering for ourselves. When we understand that no one thing in our life, no matter whether it's passing our exam with all A's or getting exactly the job that we want, no one thing is going to give us everlasting happiness, then that's a great relief. We no longer have to be disappointed for the rest of our life because we didn't get that one thing. Makes us also very humble when we see how we think we're self-made, self-made man, made all my fortune myself. We start to examine, yes, what were the causes and conditions that brought about your success? Who else contributed to where you are today? And this is another wonderful positive aspect of considering these aspects of reality, to see how interconnected we all are and how ultimately none of us is finally in charge of what's going to happen. It can often bring up a lot of fear in us because what we experience is that we're on shaky ground very often, that very often things are just moving and in that in-between state, not exactly how they used to be and not exactly how they're going to stay. And that can be quite fearful, quite unnerving. And very often when we encounter difficulties of this kind, when things change unexpectedly or change in ways that we don't like, we think we have to jump in straight away with a solution. We have to fix it up quick. We have to try to re-establish some security, to make things the way they used to be. And this is a very important point in our practice, because when we deeply understand these aspects of the unsatisfactoriness of life, it makes us willing and gives us the courage not to try to jump in with a quick solution to whatever difficulty arises that's evolving because of change, something happening in a way that I don't like. It takes a lot of courage to be able to observe our reactions rather than looking for solutions. Very often our reactions are based on wrong view, on wrong understanding. We expected that things would stay the same forever. We expected that person would never change. And so whatever solution we come up with is going to be based on wrong understanding of the realities of life. A mother came to see me recently and she said that she had just realised that her daughter in her 20s is an alcoholic, and the mother had been observing difficulties in her daughter's life for some time and had sort of been looking this way and that way trying to work out what was going wrong, until finally she had to something happened and she finally realised, the penny dropped, that her daughter is an alcoholic. Now when we face that kind of situation, we can be, of course, overwhelmed, and immediately we want to do something. We want to fix it. We want to make it better. And because of our assumptions, we can come up with all sorts of reactions. How can you do this to me? The shame of it. What have I done to create a daughter who's an alcoholic? Blame. What will the neighbours think? What will the family think? I hate the people that she's friends with. I know they're the ones who caused this. All of these sorts of reactions. But the wonderful thing that this mother did, she told me when she finally realised that this was the situation with her daughter, was that she just experienced how sad she felt. She said she spent the whole day feeling really sad because she understood the suffering that was inherent in this situation for her daughter, for her family, for those who cared about her, for those who were close to her. The mother just experienced the sadness of the difficulty that she was in, that her daughter was in, without looking for a quick solution, without looking to blame, without looking to blame her daughter or herself. And having really come in touch with her sadness, that was sort of like the ground or the rock bottom or the foundation that she knew she had to work from, that she wanted somehow to ease this situation, but she didn't necessarily know how to do it. She didn't necessarily have a quick solution. And she refrained from trying to find one. Just working from that point of sadness helped her to connect with her daughter, but also to come to the understanding that the daughter's alcoholism was the daughter's problem. And as much as the mother wanted to come up with a solution, take away the pain, that wasn't possible. And so this is one of the challenges that we all face when we come in contact with situations that are very upsetting. To be able to be in touch with our reaction and then to be able to reflect on that reaction and see whether it's based in reality or not. It may be based in our hopes and wishes, but is it really based in reality? Once we start to reflect in this way, then we have a best opportunity to come up with an answer that is going to be most appropriate. And very often, when we can't come up with an immediate answer, but we still can't get out of the situation, we find in that space that unexpected answers arise, unexpected solutions or different perspectives on the problem arise, which we would never have seen or never been open to if we jumped in straight away. So, for example, when someone is dying and they have a terminal illness and they know that there's no way they're going to get out of this one, very often life becomes much more vivid, experiences become much more precious, because we know that they know that death is just around the corner. So very simple things which in the past they wouldn't have even noticed, wouldn't even have appreciated, become sources of great joy, of great delight. So being cornered, if you like, being stuck in a situation that we don't like but that we can't get away from, or that we don't immediately try to get away from or change, can actually help us to see things in quite a different way. The way that we perceive life, the way that we take things for granted, can change dramatically without our doing anything, without our acting, but just being with that situation. And this is a very crucial aspect of our practice, to develop the strength of mind, the courage and the understanding to be able to hold back and to wait and to be with a situation before we try to fix it up. This kind of understanding comes when we reflect over and over and over again on the inherent unsatisfactoriness of life. Not that life is all miserable, but that it has this nature to it that we can't change, but which we can learn to deal with more skillfully. Buddhism is not about making things perfect. It's about learning to deal with situations as they are, more skillfully, more profitably, more wholesomely, for our own peace and happiness and for the peace and happiness of everyone that we share our lives with. So I hope that this teaching is of use for you, and that you can apply it in your life, and that this will help you in your own life to come to the end of all suffering, to help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions. So I think Judy would like to make an announcement tonight before we have the formal announcement. So if you'd all please just...